In a relationship, no matter if it's romantic or platonic, one will always learn about the other person. In romantic relationships, this rite of passage is emphasized as a major milestone, if not several. There are times when the things one learns are disappointments. You find out that your partner has a terrible sense of humor, that they snore loudly, or that, when the working day is done, they like to sit down with 2 fifths of whiskey and yell racist slurs at the neighbors. Not all discoveries are disappointing, of course, but enough that we can recognize the pattern. Then there are the other discoveries, the exciting ones, the pleasant ones, along with the exceedingly unpleasant. When one learns something new about their partner, for better or for worse, it often comes with no surprise. In a natural relationship, many new discoveries are born of guesses, things that one has wondered about the other, at least once since they met. You might wonder if your own partner likes the same crappy documentaries that you do, if they have some wild stories of theft and vandalism from their youth, or if they, by some miracle, have a rich uncle who wants to pay for your future nuptials. Whatever the case, there are some surprises that have already been imagined. Some, however, exist beyond the common imagination. There are some secrets that, when unearthed, can truly shock or amaze someone who has known their partner for years. It's true, too, that some of these secrets never get discovered. Like the dark side of the moon, there are some people who hide their true nature from their partners every day for the entirety of their life. These people, these experts in subterfuge, cloaked in darkness, are sometimes harmless, wanting only to keep certain intimate things to themselves. There is, however, another type of deceit, another type of cloak and dagger individual, whose motives are less than pure. In fact, it's proven that they can be filled with downright devilish intent.
You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of the show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
Everywhere we look, everywhere we go, every city, every town, every neighborhood, every street, there is a devil we know. This is Devil We Know, and I am your host, Aaron. Karen was an optimistic young woman with a heart of gold when she met her future husband, Christopher LeClaire. Known for her selfless attitude around the community, she first started making that name for herself with her large family, according to her brother, Frank Case. Born in 1965, Karen's addition to the dozen-plus siblings in Erie, Pennsylvania was a welcome one, as she is remembered as one of the most loving members of the family. This family didn't stay in Erie forever, though. Before Karen was able to graduate from McDowell High School, they moved all the way to California, where Karen instead attended a different school. After graduating high school in 1983, her family made another move, heading east once more to Florida. Her passion for the water and her loyal, fun-loving attitude proved an attractor for a certain Christopher LeClaire, the man that she would one day marry. Karen's family was heavily steeped in marine life, as Frank Case points out in one interview, stating that the fishing business was a given with the Cases. It came as no surprise that at each juncture, her family had moved to states with a decent amount of shoreside action. Christopher, with whom she grew enamored at age 19, also involved himself in fishing. At the end of Karen's life, he had been a commercial fisherman, and years before, he ran a bait and tackle shop on Lake Erie. Christopher's career tied in well with Karen's favorite hobbies, it seemed, as she was often fond of visiting the Cayman Islands and other hot scuba diving destinations for excursions of her own. Life next to the water was apparently in her blood, and by finding a man with the same interests, it seemed that she had hit the jackpot. Karen, for her part, had not ceased to be an inspiring presence to others around her. Even when she got engaged and then married to Christopher. In fact, after returning to her home state, she continued honing her reputation as an amazing addition to society by working at a local hobby stop in Erie, Pennsylvania. Her hard work was noticed regularly by coworkers and customers alike, and even after moving on to Superior Toyota, where she earned a career over 12 years working in the accounting department. Her reputation preceded her in her work as much as it did with her family. For anyone who encountered her had nothing but praise for the way she held herself. Her co-worker, Julie Rosenquist, whose kids remembered Karen for her sweet personality and a desk drawer full of sweets to boot, remembered many virtues of the woman that all others could agree on wholeheartedly. Not only was she considered outgoing and friendly, but her work ethic was exceptional. Karen was a model employee, and her coworkers at Superior Toyota thought of her more as family. Julie's kids were exceedingly fond of her for her generous spirit and sweet disposition. Her boss, too, thought of her as a key player in the cultural development of the dealership, and mentioned that he also thought of her as family. Karen truly was a beacon in the eyes of her community, and it showed. Perhaps because of her can-do attitude and her loyal, loving demeanor, her need to power through the troubles that her husband brought upon her was just natural. However cheery her interactions with people in the day-to-day, Karen came across trouble earlier and more often with Christopher than most people ever expect with their partners. Back when they were still dating, Christopher and Karen, along with Christopher's father, Ernest LeClaire, had a run-in with the law. According to the Elwood City Ledger, the three of them were implicated in an attempt at insurance fraud. Christopher and Ernest owned an insurance policy worth over $300,000 that they tried to incur after a fire broke out at a Mill Creek Township residence where the two were reportedly keeping inventory for their business. After investigating the event, it was discovered that the reported inventory had all either been sold or kept elsewhere, meaning that the claim to the policy was fraudulent. This was not surprising at all, considering the fact that Christopher was known for throwing his money around. He was commonly uncouth with his finances, and his debt was a consistent struggle in later life for him and his family. Back in 1990, though, this insurance fraud had landed Christopher some time in prison. While Karen was easily acquitted of all charges against her, her time as a suspect was not long, and her reputation, despite Christopher's actions, remained unsullied. One thing from her early life with Christopher and the LeClaire clan was clear, though. She did not know everything about the man she was going to marry. In fact, it turned out that he would be capable of more than Karen ever expected. Christopher LeClaire, through all of his usual business ventures, had lost more money than most people in the town would make. He was a charlatan, but in the dangerous moves toward crippling debt, the pressure was on. Perhaps that's part of what awoke him in the adulterous side that reared its ugly head in the latter half of their marriage. Christopher had begun to see a woman circa 2013 by the name of Tracy Butler, and Tracy, in her own way, was expecting much of Christopher. The man, in his usual manner of buzzwords and double talk, had found him way into an extramarital relationship, where the woman in question was swept off her feet. Perhaps she didn't get all the anger and financial stress that came with being married to Christopher. He likely saved that, and all of his other vices, for Karen at home, while he enjoyed the company of a mistress. Regardless, Tracy was smitten, and she was certain in the years that followed that she wanted to make Christopher a permanent part of her life. She insisted throughout the affair that Christopher leave his wife to start a new life with her. She expressed the desire to have kids, and Christopher, at least in his conversations with Tracy, wanted the same thing. Tracy knew that there was only so much they could do while he was still married. Christopher, though, apparently kept Tracy at arm's length, holding on to both relationships until the summer of 2017. Karen, whose marriage to Christopher had undergone a few obvious downturns, was vigilant. In the wake of Christopher's cheating and lying, about which Karen was in the dark, she worked tirelessly to repair the score-old marriage. Her attempts to bring fix to the situation were not enough, however, to appease the husband she thought she knew. Christopher had made it clear that he wasn't trying. His dalliance with Tracy was continuing at a breakneck speed, and it was later revealed that Tracy had even called an ultimatum on Christopher in an attempt to get him to leave his wife. To leave her, though, would prove to be too simple for Christopher. His efforts to end his marriage proved much more sinister than a simple divorce. On June 10, 2017, Christopher and Karen LeClaire took a trip on their fishing boat, the Doris M, out of the East Basin docks on Lake Erie, a lake which at its widest point spans 57 miles. Many fishing expeditions take place on the lake, but one of the most interesting activities that people partake in at Lake Erie is diving the shipwrecks, which are estimated to total 2,000. This particular body of water, then, covers one of the highest concentrations of shipwrecks in the world. That said, the thousands of shipwrecks that lay at the bottom of Lake Erie were no interest to Christopher, whose wife had a love of scuba diving. No, on this trip, his interest was in another sunken mystery added to the lake's floor as of June 10th. Christopher took care in making one gunshot to Karen's head with a .38 caliber revolver, with a clandestine hope that it would look like a suicide. He then tied Karen's lifeless body to an anchor and plunged her into the cool depths. His job on the water was only halfway done. but he had planned to wait it out until his next cue. Late that afternoon, it was only Christopher who returned to the dock aboard the Doris M. Karen, though, she left with him, never came back. A fact that was caught on cameras later, found on the docks. That evening, according to Tracy, Christopher returned and they spent the night together, discussing their future. Christopher told her that she would be able to move into his house the same month, a plan which had not been on the table before then. It seemed that Christopher had made his move, and he was ready to take on the new life he was planning with Tracy. Scratch that, he was almost ready. He still had one more thing to take care of out on the lake. Around 10 or 11 the next morning, he left Tracy's house and returned to Lake Erie. When he arrived at the lake, he took the boat once more out. With a stone-cold stare, alone on the water, he made his way out, about 3 miles off the coast, when he made a surprising call. He reached out to the U.S. Coast Guard, and he told them that Karen had fallen out of the boat and into the water. And soon enough, there was an armada of search team professionals on the lake, looking for Karen LeClaire in the water. Christopher stood by as the search expanded, dock by dock, mile by mile, until aircraft hummed above with an intent to find the missing person. After over 30 hours on the water, having searched over 1,400 square miles, the Coast Guard finally called their search, declaring Karen dead. To have pored over so much land and water without a sign of their potential drowning victim was discouraging. More than that, though, the chances that she was still alive somewhere on the lake had dwindled drastically. The search had been harrowing, expensive, and vast. And all the while, there was Christopher LeClaire, whose contributions had been succinct. He had not offered much in information at all. Like he'd said, Karen had simply fallen off the boat. Then why wouldn't he have more to say? Wouldn't he, like all innocent men, have more to offer investigators during their search? Needless to say, he wasn't nearly as cooperative as he could have been, should have been, in the search for his very own wife. And that, more than anything, rubbed police the wrong way. They decided to get Christopher alone, and they had themselves a very long discussion. When Christopher LeClaire talked with Pennsylvania State Police on June 12th, he recollected his version of events, of his last days with Karen. According to his statement, he and Karen spent the entirety of June 10th on Lake Erie, cleaning out their fishing nets. He said the state of the water made his job difficult, so they went back home and stayed there until the following day. That, he said, was when they decided to have a second go at the lake, right around noon. After they headed out to the water was when he claimed she fell overboard. That, too, was when he claimed he made the distress call. Only during the course of the interview did Christopher eventually mention the affair he had been having over the past several months. When Tracy did come up, the investigators asked Christopher when he had last had sex with her. While initially stating that he had last met with her several months ago, he afterward confirmed that the last time he did see her was on the 9th of that month. June, it seemed, was a busy season for lying, cheating murderers. But Christopher's agenda was anything but clear. With this interview out of the way, it was time for the police to approach Tracy Butler, the mistress and the girlfriend for whom Christopher's lying did no good. Tracy, when asked about her rendezvous with Christopher on June 9th, denied ever seeing him that day. Instead, she insisted Christopher came over in the evening of June 10th, and he stayed until he headed back out mid-morning, the same time he would have been headed over to the docks to board the Doris M, with or without his wife, Karen. Lying, it seemed, was no good for Christopher, and the police made headway with the surveillance videos that captured Christopher's activities on the docks those 2 days in June. While watching Christopher and Karen leave together around noon on the 10th, the police knew that they were going to have to expect one of two things. When the Doris M returned with its single passenger aboard, however, the police had fewer questions to answer. Of course, once they reviewed the footage from the 11th, in which Christopher is aboard the boat alone, once more just over an hour before he was to call the authorities, their suspicions were confirmed completely. Not only was Christopher lying about the activity and his whereabouts, but circumstantial evidence of his guilt in Karen's disappearance was considerable. He had no alibi, and Karen was missing after an outing with him over the vast, verdant surface of the Great Lake. It was enough for law enforcement to make their next move. Around midnight, after June 13th had nearly gone, the court read their charges against their newest accused felon, Christopher LeClaire, who pled innocent, was accused of criminal homicide. His crime was against his known wife, Karen LeClaire, and all the court had to do was prove it. Later in the day, investigators were able to serve search warrants, with rights to look at both LeClaire's cell phones, as well as that of Tracy Butler. The dark corners of Christopher's existence were slowly coming to light. as his house and his vehicle also underwent searching. The police were taking samples of DNA from the house, hair and saliva, in the hopes that when they found Karen's body, they'd be able to know for sure. It's important to note that everyone who heard about Karen was deeply distressed by the event. Whether they knew about Christopher's part in her disappearance from the get-go, or whether they heard from Christopher himself, like Karen's co-workers, they all said the same thing. Why Karen? Her reputation throughout the community as a selfless individual had spread like wildfire throughout her time in her Pennsylvania town. But there was one final note of concern. Something that may well have answered the question, why Karen? Long before Christopher could think up an excuse. Karen LeClaire, it was said, had a life insurance policy. Soon it was over 2 weeks since Christopher's arraignment, and nothing was to be said of finding Karen's body, at least not until Independence Day. We will be right back after these short messages. July 4th rolled around lazily onto Lake Erie and the surrounding communities, and only on that day did a boater come across what appeared to be a human body. Female, from the looks of it. The body, floating in the water 6 miles off the coast, was nearest to Dunkirk, New York, which was still a ways away from the East Basin dock where the Doris M. sat, also lifeless. Christopher had made his bed, thinking he wouldn't have to lie in it. Evidently, though, he had soiled the bed. He had made it all too easy to be caught in his lie. Now it was cleanup time. The discovery of Karen's body in Lake Erie was nothing short of disturbing. Christopher, when disposing of her body, had not only tied her to the boat anchor, but he had tied her ankles around as well. The state of the body did not look conducive to an accident drowning in the least. Christopher's initial defense was already not holding much water, so to speak. Now it was leaking profusely. In the autopsy after Karen's body was positively identified, the time came for the examiner to determine cause of death. Judging from the wide bullet hole in her head, it was evident that the accident which Christopher concocted on the 11th was only a fallacy. The layman would have to assume that Christopher was to blame. And the experts, well, they knew the truth. With all the proof they had, it was simply a matter of making the case. When the bullet hole was discovered, police went back to the footage that surveyed Christopher during his time in the Erie County Prison, and they discovered an unsettling conversation between him and his father, Ernest LeClaire. Apparently, when Ernest visited his son, Christopher's discussion with him involved a gun. He asked his father whether he had taken care of the weapon, and Ernest, eager to help his boy, said yes. It was more than enough confirmation to place Ernest under arrest while they conjure up yet another search warrant, this time checking the boat which served as the crime scene, along with the house once more. Thanks to this tip, the police recovered the murder weapon, a .38 caliber revolver, along with ropes on the boat that matched the type used to bind Karen's body before she was waterborne. Ernest, for all he did to help his son cover up the crime, was charged with tampering with evidence. His work with the gun and his son's blatant disregard for caution had landed him in prison alongside his killer son with a $25,000 bond. The very next day, Ernest posted the 10% needed to walk away, while Christopher sat and waited for trial to come. Christopher had time to write in prison. He wrote some letters, in fact, wherein he professed his innocence in the events prior, much to the bewilderment of law officials. He delivered a narrative in which his wife, the selfless and beloved, decided to end her life. In his version of events, she shot herself in the head, awash with agony over the affair that Christopher was having. Sure, Karen was working hard to repair the marriage that Christopher had actively abandoned, but this story of his was just that, a story. It was a story that conflicted directly with his first, but Christopher even had a reason for that. According to him, the guilt he felt was immense. After all, it was his wanton actions that had earned Karen an early, watery grave. He stated in these letters that he himself had discovered the body first, but after dumping the body into the lake, he was warded off by police in the area. The narrative paints Christopher as meek, a victim, a person adjacent to tragedy, but he never took responsibility for the acts that were clearly committed. Eventually, though, Christopher's defense attorney was forced to push forth the story that Christopher had fabricated. The 6 letters written by Christopher were read in court by a police officer who testified as lead investigator of the case. And the story Christopher weaved in these letters also portrayed a person of compassion. In one of the letters he wrote, "I didn't want anyone to know what she had done. I tied her to an anchor and let her go." He claims to have taken, in his words, screenshots of the body he found before the police called him off the water. However elaborate it was beginning to sound, the story was barely palatable to the court. Try as Christopher might to claim innocence, the evidence pointed to the contrary in most respects. Nevertheless, the defense pulled out all the stops they had. Namely, they called to the stand their one defense witness, an ace that was overpowered all too easily, Dr. Carl Williams, Allegheny County's chief medical examiner. Dr. Williams, upon review of the autopsy report and the photographs of the body, attested to the appearance of the self-inflicted gunshot wound. This may have been the defense's ace in the hole, their best bet at landing some sort of nabbed innocence for Christopher. However, before that could happen, the prosecution then cross-examined Dr. Williams and his expert testimony. When asked if he would have taken other circumstances into account, he stated that if he were the medical examiner in this case, he would have a high likelihood of coming to another conclusion. The prosecution, for their part, had many more aces up their sleeve, of course. The elimination of the defense, One Hope, was well underway. Even the defense attorney was noted to sound disbelieving in his delivery of the suicide story. Whatever the prosecution had left was simply left to clinch the decision of the court in an undeniable sweep. During the trial, Tracy Butler, the mistress, was called to the stand. One would have assumed that her story would at least somewhat support Christopher and his alibi, his defenses against the allegations against him. But Tracy was more than forthright. She first confirmed the actual length of their relationship. While Christopher's statement held that he had only been seeing Tracy for several months, her account painted a much larger picture. She attested that she had been entangled romantically with Christopher since 2013 in an on-again, off-again relationship, wherein they lived together for 8 months. This differed greatly from the relationship that Christopher described, which was chalked up to a brief dalliance. Text messages they shared showed a deeper side, revealing a relationship where the two claimed to be in love. It was even discovered that the two were trying to get pregnant together, trying to form a family, a new life. She gave an account of their actual clandestine relationship in detail on the stand, discussing Christopher's promises of marriage and of wanting to leave his wife. Tracy, of course, had been pushing for divorce, but it was obvious to the court that Christopher's solution was much more drastic. In fact, Prosecutor Elizabeth Herz addressed his decision, quote, "Rather than just leave Karen, this man decides to take her out on his boat and shoot her. It's chilling what he did that day," end quote. While Tracy may have been asking Christopher to start a new life with her, it was Christopher who decided that meant ending another life entirely. Tracy also mentioned to police another incriminating factoid about her relationship with Chris. Apparently, while eating with Tracy and her children, Christopher discussed a life insurance policy that he had on his wife. This policy, which totaled at $30,000, would have been in effect for an accidental death, and it was likely that Christopher's first story was fabricated to earn that policy's payout in full. The age-old tale of a cheating spouse taking out the life insurance policy on their partner to start anew with the homewrecker was a story that was recognizable enough to turn heads in the courtroom. But it was clear, with enough time, that the mistress had nothing to do with it. Tracy simply wanted a family, and although this motive may seem like enough to encompass the situation in its full capacity, there was more to the story. More that, like First Assistant D.A. Elizabeth Herz said, was chilling. She wasn't wrong about that, not by a long shot of a .38 caliber revolver. As if the conversations in prison weren't enough to condemn Ernest and Christopher in some sort of collusion, the court brought in recordings of phone calls between the two men. While Christopher sat quietly in the courtroom, speaking not a word on his own behalf, jury and judge alike heard Christopher LeClaire from early in June asking his father to get rid of the gun. True, if one was attempting to hide a suicide, there would be a discussion about the method of self-infliction. There might even be an attempt to hide the evidence of the self-harm, if possible. However, the actions that were taken, along with the circumstantial evidence surrounding them, point toward a more sinister occurrence. The hiding of the murder weapon, the lapse in alibi, the motive for murder, and the uncooperative nature of Christopher's interactions with the police during the search for Karen, all were used in the implication of Christopher and Karen's murder. It was possible, though, under the shaky defense of suicide and survivor's guilt, that each of these occurrences could have supported Christopher's version of events. There was, however, one last piece of evidence, something that surpassed even the discovery of the affair, of the life insurance policy, of even the revolver that was used to end Karen's life. Christopher's M.O. Christopher, as fate would have it, had discussed his plans to kill Karen before 2017. In fact, the plan he had was in mind for over 10 years without so much as a peep from the witnesses until the fateful event occurred. Two witnesses, on separate occasions, recall conversing with Christopher, who had ruminated on killing his wife by taking her out on the lake and throwing her overboard. This fantasy of his was remembered from one witness's conversation with Christopher in 2011. The other, though, was much earlier. The first witness mentioned of murdering Karen was placed in the year 2014, almost 13 years before her actual death. 13 years is a hell of a long time to plan a murder, and Judge John J. Tresilla commented on the act before Christopher, whose silence in the courtroom was still unsettling. Judge Tresilla called Karen a ray of light, stating that she was a selfless, giving soul. It was then that he turned his attention to the selfish life before him, referring now to Christopher. Quote, "The depravity and depths that you went to calculate this murder are unlike any this court has ever seen," end quote. He said with conviction as he sentenced Christopher to life in prison without parole, plus 3 3/4 to 17 years for murder in the first degree, in addition to charges related to his cover-up of the attack and the illegality of his use of the firearm. To Christopher, life in prison would have been too light of a sentence. Tresilla then tacked on some extra years and charged him with over $700,000 to reimburse the state for their search and rescue efforts. The extra years on top of the life sentence were thrown in for good measure, making sure that the punishment did indeed fit the crime. As he said, and as Karen's brother Frank Case said in response to the case, there was a selfless life paired with a selfish one. And the selfish one decided to take until he could take no more from Karen, whose selflessness touched the lives of this community in many, many ways. There were dark days indeed for the people of Erie County, but at least some justice had now been served. It's not every day that one's life is upturned by the deceit and ill will of a loved one. It happens, of course, but not often enough to warrant a road sign tipping off the next drivers to head down Lover's Lane. The gamble of living with another individual is the fact that, no matter how much you learn about them, you can never know everything. Every thought, every wish, every urge, it's all too much and it's too personal. That's why commitment means so much. When you marry another person, for example, it's under the assumption that for the foreseeable future, the person you marry is the person you want to spend the rest of your life with. It's a huge decision, and with it comes a commitment to the person you know, or rather, to the person you feel like you know. The truth of it is, the commitment can have a backlash, since sometimes we enter into agreements, big and small, with people who aren't what they seem, whether it's that they have a misunderstanding of the agreement or that they simply don't agree to the terms. There are many people that break these commitments without batting an eyelash. There are those, too, who simply enter a commitment, like a marriage, under false pretenses. When you find a marriage, a commitment like that, it's hard to reconcile what the course of action should be. Though many people find separating and ending the commitment to be an effective policy, there are others who find value in the relationship on a if-only basis. These people, motivated in part by what could be work to manage and repair their lost connection with their partner, and if the partner is simply a perception based on falsehoods, then the salvation of such a relationship is almost always out of the question. Relationships are tricky, they're complex, with many moving parts. But at the root of it all, there's always just two people, and these two people, whether they know it or not, are expecting transparency of sort. If not, the whole thing falls apart. The same thing goes for people whose ulterior motives are sheltered through years of meaningless experiences. Though the life you experience with your partner may have meaning and emotion attached, if your partner doesn't share those sentiments, then the committed relationship between the two of you no longer exists. In fact, the longer a person can keep themselves locked away with the thought of being rid of their partner, the more likely it is that the relationship they had never meant anything to them in the beginning. They most likely began under the same fallacy, and will maintain it until they get what they want. That's the cruel part. Some people really are that selfish and conniving. And a person like that isn't someone you want around. A person like that in our lives, no matter what role they play, is in it simply for what they stand to gain. They're not the type of person to give your life to. So if you reveal one early enough, remember to stand clear of them. They break the myriad of promises they make to enter our lives, playing the part of a devil we know. Thanks for listening to Devil We Know. We will be back next Friday with a brand new episode. Also, stay tuned. We will be launching our Patreon page August 27th. Will be the first release of an episode. You can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/devilweknow. Again, I'd like to thank you guys so much for the 5-star reviews you're leaving on iTunes. They really help a lot. Again, if you would leave your name, I would love to shout you guys out. There have been several since our last episode, and we greatly appreciate that. Please keep those coming in. Here's two more podcasts that I found that I really enjoy. Please check out these promos and go over and subscribe to their podcasts. And until next week, stay safe.
Hello, everyone. This is Robin Warder, host of the true crime podcast, The Trail Went Cold. If you grew up watching the classic television show Unsolved Mysteries, then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I profile a new unsolved murder or missing persons case and share all the baffling details. Afterward, I provide my own personal analysis and theories about what might have happened. This is a show for true crime buffs who are fascinated by cold cases and love to discuss them and pick them apart in an attempt to figure out the truth. So be sure to check out our podcast to learn about some truly bizarre unsolved mysteries where the trail went cold.
Hi, I'm Joel.
And I'm Phil, and we're the co-hosts of Florida Men, a true crime comedy podcast.
Each week on Florida Men, we bring you stories from the shady side of the Sunshine State, starring America's most prolific criminal, Florida Man.
Stories with headlines like
Florida Man carrying live alligator chases people in a convenience store,
and Florida Woman calls 911 on a possum.
You can find Florida Men on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are found.